All right. Hello, my name is Roger Perry, and I've been living in the wonderful city of Shelby since around 2013, and I moved to North Carolina from Northern Virginia in 2012.
Would that be the D.C. area of Northern Virginia?
That's right. I lived out in the town of Herndon, which most people don't know where that is, but if you know where Dulles Airport is, it's basically where Herndon is.
There you go. So probably a much more urban lifestyle than what is here, right?
For most of my life, but it was kind of strange because through the weekdays, I lived in a suburb, definitely a lot more urban than Shelby in Cleveland County. But one of my grandmothers lived across the river, Potomac River in Montgomery County, Maryland, and that's a farming community. So some weekends, I'd go spend my childhood on a farm. Right. But my other grandma, she lived in Baltimore City in an apartment complex, and that was even a more urban area.
Yes, it is.
So I'd spend some weekends in the city, some weekends in the country, and the rest of my life in the suburbs.
There you go. So did music start for you at that time?
Music was something that came into my life, I always say, a little bit later, just like everything. I was always a slow bloomer with everything I ever got into. My father was a musician, and he had some guitars around, but he was also a busy full-time worker, as was my mother. I was one of those latchkey kids.
Yeah, oh yeah, I understand.
But he would sometimes break out the guitar and play, and he listened to, every time we'd take day trips somewhere, he would listen to a lot of music in the car. He was very much into Carpenters, so my early exposure to music is a lot of Karen Carpenter vocals.
Karen's talented, was talented, without a doubt, you know, without a doubt. Did your dad's playing influence you, or, I mean, did you say, well, maybe I want to do this at some point, or didn't give it much thought?
I think I put it all on the back burner. I was definitely proud of him when we would go over to church retreats and we'd have our talent show. Right. And that's about the only time I'd see him break out the guitar and do some old sets like he used to do in the early 60s when he was a folk singer. But the biggest thing that opened me up to him and that style of music was we took a trip across the country. It was shortly after 9/11, back in 2001. And we spent 2 weeks in a rental car, and we drove out from Virginia to Oregon and then down to LA and then back again. And we had a whole bunch of CDs of musicians that he knew. We had Tom Paxton. Yeah. I got introduced to John Fahey, Pete Seeger, Woody Guthrie, Roy Buchanan.
That's a strange pop into that mix.
Oh yeah, it was not all folk stuff. It was. I also got introduced to some electric stuff there. But that trip across the country really opened my mind to a lot of Americana music and a lot of great artists.
Sure, I mean, those were mainstay people of the early folk movement. You know, particularly the Washington area, New York City area. I mean, that was the people in the scene.
Yeah. I think the interesting part is my dad had known all these people, so he'd play all this music. He'd be telling stories like, for instance, his friend John Fahey was a quiet man. Back in D.C., when they were done playing folk sets at the Roadhouse, usually around 1 or 2 in the morning, there was an Esso station in Tacoma Park, Maryland, where all these artists would just kind of gather and jam. And John Fahey used to drive up there in his Cadillac, and he had his cat named Lion, would ride with him in the car and just kind of sit on the dashboard. Oftentimes, he had these records from his own Tacoma Park studio where he was recording a lot of his stuff. But they'd get into jams, and evidently, like, John Fahey had an affinity for my dad's Martin guitar because it had a weird buzz. It had flaws in it that he really loved. So he would pick it up and play on it. It's even rumored that he might have recorded some of his own music on that guitar.
That's really cool.
That was one of the two guitars I grew up with in the house, too.
Right, that's great. I mean, that's a kind of a piece of Americana history right there, without a doubt. So I guess he had left that, though, by the time you came along. I mean, he had pretty well give up the...
Yeah, my dad had done a lot of things in his life. Around the time he was a folk singer, he had also worked with Mississippi Freedom Movement out of the University of Maryland. He got drafted into Vietnam, and he served in Vietnam. He says that it was in basic training is where his voice got killed. They made him do a lot of the chants, lead a lot of the chants because they knew he was the singer. Right. And also, he got into some active combat in Vietnam. So he said by the time he got home, his voice was just not the same, and he had gotten into a lot more solid type of work.
Yeah.
But he still had some of his range. So now and then, come nightfall, he would go and play some of the tunes and sing along with them. But yeah, he definitely had retired a bit from music.
So at what point did you decide maybe music is something I want to do?
It was a slow progression. Like, I had started to get interested in music when I was about 10 years old. We would do these church retreats. I was in the Episcopal Church at the time. And in Virginia, the Episcopal Diocese of Virginia, they had a retreat center out in the mountains. That was another thing that where I fell in love with the mountains and nature was out there, is in Orkney Springs, Virginia. And what was interesting about it was they had one of those old wooden Civil War era Springs hotels that never burnt down. Never burnt down. So this place had a lot of rooms, and all of those rooms had a lot of pianos in them. And I used to haul off by myself to one of these pianos and was just noodling around. That's where I started to learn that the keys were actually in patterns, and I learned about the octaves. And my dad eventually got me an electric keyboard. I guess he kind of noticed that I was kind of into it, and I got to practice a bit at home. And by the end of it, I taught myself not how to read or write music, but how to play by ear,
right,
for sure.
Sure. Well, I mean, that's a wonderful thing. I think so many American musicians learn to play that way.
Yeah, but in terms of being a performer, because I was always a very shy, only child, it was Shelby moving here to Cleveland County really opened me up to that. For one thing, I didn't have a whole bunch of friends that I had a long history with, so it's almost like a fresh chance to start over again as another person. I always say that this is my second life.
Yeah, I can understand that. It's a pretty good place to pick up a second life, you know?
Oh, yeah, and get a lot of influence from so many great musicians, too.
There's a ton of them here. And I know that you are big into the outside, and there's plenty of that here, too.
Yep, that's the one thing I do try to bring over here with me. Because I guess I did some jamming back in my last days in North Virginia when I was changing my character in transition. I had done some jamming with an interesting band group in a warehouse out behind the airport. And we did a lot of reggae covers.
Yeah,
we were into some island music.
Sure.
And I think that led me to get into music festivals. One of them, we'd always heard these rumors about Floyd Fest.
Oh, yeah.
And I finally got some cash in my pocket and took my old car down there and got me a ticket at the gate and attended it. And that was a big transformation of my world.
Life-changing.
Life-changing in many, many ways. Just the exposure to different music.
Oh, yeah.
People that I'd eventually come to love that I wasn't really even aware of the future connections I get in with. I know Acoustic Syndicate was playing out there, but my favorite thing was like 3 o'clock in the morning, electronic fusion bands at the global stage.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun. Floyd Fest is how I got into North Carolina in the first place, though. I ran into a guy And he was doing these peace retreats over in Black Mountain. And I visited North Carolina. My dad took me on a trip on the way to Disney World. We stopped over in North Carolina, but that was about my only exposure to here. So I went blind out to Western North Carolina, not knowing what I was going to get into. 8-hour drive, and I finally get into Black Mountain. Now, this is the place where they have the Lake Eden Arts Festival.
It is.
But my first exposure to it, it was completely to us. And there was only 12 of us there, and we were camped out. And there's some great music that I ran into over there, but I think it was just the mountains and the spirit of the land.
Yeah, that'll do it.
It really spoke to me. And it's also where I had my first exposure to the flutes. There was a flute maker there. His name was Danny. And he brought some flutes with him, and they were for sale. And back then, I had I was able to save a lot more money from my job at a community college, at Northern Virginia Community College. So I went and bought a flute from him, and it was a drone flute. So it had one hole would just have a constant tone, and then the other you can manipulate, and you'd blow into them, and it would produced the wind through both of them at the same time, made this interesting effect. I noodled around with it for a little bit while I was there before I purchased it, and I was like, I think I could pick this up. And then about in a week, I sounded like I could like kind of do it, and then I've just gotten the habit of playing them out in the woods and even busking with them for a few years. So that's how I got into my North American wood flute playing career.
Do you still have that first flute?
I do. I try not to break it out too much. It's a very special flute. I need to go get new leather on it, but usually one or two times a year on special occasions, I'll go and bring it.
Since we're talking about flutes, so I take it there's a reed in there. Like a saxophone of some type, or is there not?
Well, on the flute, the North American style wood flute, and this is based on different things from different Native American tribes, mostly out from the Southwest. They have a object on it called the bird.
Okay.
And under the bird, once you blow through the mouthpiece, it will come up through a hole under the bird, and then there's a little channel that the bird sits on, and then there's a separate hole on the other side, and the wind almost goes above and below, and they say that is the thing that goes and gets, I guess, the reverberation effect to get the volume out of it, and then changing the positions of your fingers will change the keys on it.
Oh, okay. I was curious. So it doesn't have a reed, so it's just that's cool.
Yeah, the whole flute in some way acts as the reed. Right. The bird is the specialized piece that definitely comes from the native cultures.
So in a lot of ways, it is like a standard flute. I mean, it's pretty much breath-powered. It's not like really having a reed or the mouthpiece. I noticed the mouthpieces aren't like, let's say, we'll take horns or a trumpet.
No.
The mouthpiece comes off. The mouthpiece is every bit as much as important as the horn itself. So
yeah,
but those are fixed.
They are fixed, and because I've played some reed instruments before, and they take a lot of pressure on your lips, on your breath. And I'm not a person that's been blessed with the best lungs in the world. That's why I never really got into sports careers.
It's hard to get the embouchure right on things with reeds.
Yeah. But the North American wood flutes are a lot more easier to play, I feel, than other types of flutes out there. I think anybody could really learn the basics of them. It's just like with anything, it takes practice, but there's a lot of simple songs that you can get pretty quickly just memorizing your position on the fingers.
Did this start your affection for different instruments also? I mean, did that come with the flute?
I think it did, really. Yeah. I was always a keyboard person until I started to get in the flutes, and it gave me the confidence to be like, well, I wonder what other things I could play. Now, I've run into people that can, keeping with the flute category, they would get me different flutes from around the world. I've had them given to me from Turkey. I have a Lithuanian shepherd's flute.
A didgeridoo, you know, something like that.
The didgeridoo I have not had the breath power for. I hope to pick that up one day. I have the great thing about going to the Lake Eden Arts Festival, the Leaf Festival, they used to have like musical instrument petting zoos and people bringing a wide variety of world instruments. So I've gotten to practice with them and then hear people that have completely mastered them.
Right. Oh, yeah.
But I think between picking up the flutes in Black Mountain and just the other types of international music I've seen there, it got me to explore more. Like one of the ones I'm working with currently, I got an accordion.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to teach myself how to play that. That's one that I just, you have to play by feeling, basically. It's so large, you can't even see where your fingers are. So it's a lot of muscle memory.
It is. It is an extremely difficult instrument, really.
Yeah.
It's like a piano that you have to squeeze.
And I'll do some hand drumming. I've gone to djembe classes, but I've found that the amount of strength and calluses that you need in your fingers to be good with the djembe, it just makes it too tight for me to play the piano after
sure.
every time I do a session.
Yeah, I'm sure that does. I've known percussionists whose hands are beat to death. I mean, they have calluses and all, but, well, I know a lot of drummers whose hands ache, you know, that is a whole separate skill in itself.
Yeah.
Hand drumming of any type. You know, the drum circles are fun. I think drum circles are really great to teach people of any age, not just children, basic music timing. I think you get out of that more than anything else, how to count time and know that there is, even with drums, a structure of music there. It does not sound like it sometimes, you know. Sometimes it sounds pretty random, but it is actually the science part of what people think is art.
Oh, yeah. Drum circles are fantastic. I've been in a lot of them. We used to have a lot more in Shelby, too,
yeah,
in the early days.
We used to have them all the time. But, well, I saw Justin. I guess Justin's moved on past
Justin
Harper.
Well, I can talk about Justin a little because he's become my best friend. He's almost my brother in some ways. We say that our personalities are so similar, we're kind of like brothers from different mothers, but that's how I met him. He was doing a drum circle out there at the Council of the Arts building, I think in 2013, and I came and I had a couple flutes in my backpack. I was still nervous because I had made a few friends in Shelby, but quite frankly they were North Virginia exiles. I was still trying to get some local friends over here, and Justin, in leading his drum circle, he looks over and I guess he saw my backpack, and he quietly comes up because I was just sitting and noodling around on the drum. He's like, hey, do you think you could play some of your flutes on this next one? Like, I'll go get a rhythm going, and can you just, you know, break up one of those and see if you can improv something. And I'm like, yeah, give it a shot. So he gets everybody into a rhythm and says, we're going to have a special surprise. And I break out one of my flutes and I start jamming along with it and switch to another and another. And then after it was done, that was it. We've talked to each other many, many times after that.
He's a very fine musician and he's done a lot for youth music in Cleveland County.
He sure has.
Besides being a teacher in the school system, he has run so many things out of the old Scruggs Center up here, teaching young people everything from drums to guitar.
Yep. Sometimes I've even partnered with them. There's a couple times I just help them set up the drum circle, and we've done that act with breaking out the flutes at the end of it as a treat for people there. There was one occasion that we did a musical instrument petting zoo over here at the Scruggs Center a few years back. And since I had a collection of weird instruments myself, I brought them along. Now, obviously, I don't. The flute is nothing that you want to go and particularly share with a bunch of strangers.
Yes, harmonicas are the same way, yeah.
But I was more than glad to go and demonstrate how to play them and let the kids, you know, just touch them and see. I remember there was one young man that was blind that came to the musical instrument petting zoo, and I got to introduce him to the accordion. I'm saying that's a great one for a blind musician because you basically can't see what you're doing anyway. Right. I got to let him experience how other instruments feel and whatnot, and that was great. I'm just glad that a place like this can offer opportunities like that to all of the kids.
Right here in the center, there is a instrument petting room, right, a whole room that is full of acoustic music, musical instruments, even xylophones, you know, something as simple as egg shakers, two upright bass, two violins, banjos, guitars, everything else is over there. Steel string guitars, nylon string guitars. So there's a lot of cool stuff that's over there for, well, and adults come in and pick those up too, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's never too late.
Oh, no.
Hardly too young and never too late, so.
No, never too late. Yeah, because you just never know what is going to be the first experience that can start the career of a great artist or start you on a new path if you are an existing musician. Case in point, like, I've always been a keyboard player and I've always been a flute player, and it was much later that I ran into this one-of-a-kind instrument. It's called the Gordimer. I guess how that starts is one Christmas, my dad got me a lap dulcimer, a mountain dulcimer.
Sure.
And I noodled around with it, but I was in an unfortunate situation where my two keyboards were stolen out of my house. I never got them back, but they didn't steal the lap dulcimer.
Of course they didn't. I mean, I'm surprised they didn't leave you on a second one.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a joke.
Well, yeah, yeah. But it forced me to sit down for many months before I saved up the money and got my insurance reimbursement and got a couple new keyboards. But for a while, I just sat there and really focused on how to work with the lap dulcimer. And then a few years later, Justin Harper, again, he had inherited two instruments from a musician that had moved to this area. He had two one-of-a-kind style instruments. One of them was called the dulcitar. This was a gigantic mountain dulcimer that was strung like a sitar, and it had about 8 strings on it. You could run a bow across it. You could pluck it. You could put it all sorts of weird tunings. It was phenomenal. And he had a second instrument, and this one was called the Gordimer. And this was a mountain dulcimer neck that was put on the field gourd, kind of like one that you could get up in Kayser Dried,
right,
as a sound chamber. And it had a banjo-style rigging for the strings, and it was made in Old Fort, North Carolina in 1973 by a mountain artisan named Clyde Hollifield. I've heard, like, this Clyde, I think, is more popular for puppets that he made. He was kind of a gypsy mountain artisan. But at one point in his career, he was making a whole bunch of these instruments. I think Justin even managed to track Clyde down where he was living when he was 90 years old, and got him to tell him a little bit of the techniques that he used to make these things. But they are interesting. But I got Justin to let me borrow the Gordimer. And I was noodling around with it, and I realized I finally found a string instrument that I could play like a guitar. Because every time I pick up a guitar, I just find that my fingers are just, they're narrow artist fingers. I have a lot of trouble bridging a traditional guitar to make the chords, but the Gordimer only had 3 strings, and it was missing a few frets too. That kind of makes it easier. Just about anything that you hit could sound good. But I learned to use it in a capo to hit all sorts of folk songs that my dad used to sing. And that gave me a whole new release to start working on my voice, which is usually something that I never put into anything. Everybody's always telling me they thought I'd be a good singer, but I'm just always too shy to go and pursue it. But something about the Gordimer just being my simple background music helped me to really focus on trying to get my voice to bring these old folk songs back to life.
Well, it's a pretty interesting instrument. You played Dark as a Dungeon on it today.
Yes, I did.
And so did you have to learn to, is it more like a dulcimer to play or more like a guitar?
It's a strange.
I mean, you chorded sort of with it.
Oh, yeah. That's the thing is, it's beyond a dulcimer. A dulcimer, just by laying it down, and well, I mean, mountain dulcimer. The hammered dulcimer is a completely different beast.
That's just a piano.
Yeah, that's just a piano that you
hit. Without keys.
Yeah. I've noodled around with them, too. But the mountain dulcimer, as you play it traditionally, you can do a little bit of chord work in it.
Little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. But not like you can when you flip it as a guitar. And the art that you can't capo a mountain dulcimer.
True.
And running the capo at different positions, like there's one part of the neck, everything that I play sounds kind of like almost like Eastern Gypsy type music, stuff that Django Reinhardt could get into. Another one, you capo it higher up and you've got yourself a mandolin
that you
could be doing. I found it ended up being more versatile. For one thing, you could play just about every Christmas song, traditional Christmas song ever made on it. And many more things. I've gotten into doing some things with it too that you wouldn't normally think of on a mountain dulcimer. I do some Tom Petty covers in my show.
That's cool.
I've messed around a little bit with stuff from Sting and the Police.
There you go. Oh, that's that reggae background.
You can do so. I've done some Bob Marley tunes on it. Many things. I started out playing a lot of Woody Guthrie music on it.
There's nothing wrong with playing Woody.
Yeah, just all sorts of stuff. But that's what I love about it. It gives me access to what other people that can carry an acoustic guitar feel. You have, the guitar, of course, it has all sorts of frets. So you can play anything on the guitar if you put your heart and mind to it, for sure.
Yeah.
Maybe one day I'll actually go and pick it up, but for me, the Gordimer has been that freedom of experience. I could walk out on the street and start playing now.
Right. There is a kind of a big difference. But, I mean, there is qualities of a sitar there in the fact that there's a lot of different tones within the instrument itself, not the fact that, with a guitar, you know what you're going to get.
Right.
You don't know, and surely with the times I put my hands on sitars, I had no idea what I was doing and where it goes. So I would think it was kind of the same with that.
It was a little bit that way, especially getting started with it. But over time, I've gotten to the point that I can start breaking out tunes a lot faster now. I think I've been playing the Gordimer for roughly, let's say, about 6 years now.
You play that on the show with I know you do that on your solo shows. You do that with Justin?
It's been a while, actually. Yeah, the first year that I felt comfortable with the Gordimer, there was a Art of Sound Festival, and we really raked it up. So back then, Justin and I were with Tommy Forney.
Yeah, I know Tommy.
With Gypsy Swing 30. So we did a show just doing some Django Reinhardt stuff. Now, I don't know if I used the Gordimer in that one. I know I used the flutes and the keyboards, but Justin and I broke out the Gordimer and the dulcimer, and we played over at Walker Woodworking, and we did an expo on weird instruments.
Right.
And then we also did a busking job that same day, and we called that group No by Lar. Oh my gosh. Well, it was a strange Spanish name, but he had gotten a strange mariachi Spanish guitar, and I used a Gordimer, and we figured out some jam rhythms that were kind of Latin ahead of time, and then just improvised.
That's pretty cool. Speaking of that, have you ever thought about taking it and busking in Asheville?
I've thought about it.
You realize the money in busking in Asheville, right?
I hear you could rake it up. I've had some people tell me Asheville is the place I should go. I've had other people begging me to go to Black Mountain.
I think they're trying to move it over to that way a little bit. But Asheville is where you can make some serious cash a day busking in Asheville, particularly if you got a novelty deal.
Yeah, I might be thinking about it. I definitely moved to this region with intentions of hopping over to Asheville originally. But I got to tell you the truth. The more I experienced the Asheville and the more I experienced the Shelby, I found Shelby, I think, is my home.
I think, Asheville's got a lot of cool to it. Asheville is also a very expensive place to live.
Yes.
I think everyone would love to live in Asheville. But everyone can't. So
everyone can't, and outside of the expense part of it, there's just a lot of people coming in and out. Some of them are great people. I'll give you that. You can also run into some not so great characters too.
Sure.
But I found so many friends and friends of friends and full circle connections just hanging out in Shelby and Cleveland County in general. And I branch out. There's a lot happening in little places like Rutherford.
There is.
Kings Mountain is picking up its own little scene. Boiling Springs. This whole region is making it so. Asheville is always an option, but I find myself like, well, then I could just drive 30 minutes up to here or there.
Exactly. And you don't have to deal with the traffic of Asheville.
Yep.
And no one wants to go except for Charlotte musicians to Charlotte to play music.
Yeah.
I'm not a fan of Charlotte music. Everyone who's heard this podcast knows that. So it's nothing new today. I still haven't changed my mind.
Yeah, well, honestly, I'm probably going to get – I haven't been to Charlotte very much at all. I still kind of have a phobia of cities. But there is a young female artist from this region, Mariah Van Cleef.
Yeah.
I ran into her over at River Keeper's after party where she was doing a solo set. She's on tonight, by the way, at Newgrass. But anyhow, we struck up a conversation, and I have some flutes on a backing track for some of her new material that's coming out, and we're going to do a live show over in Charlotte March 17th at a place called Petra's. I've never been there, and I got to go up there to rehearse, but... I don't think I'm doing the full show, but I'm going to be working with the live arrangement of that very complicated piece. Definitely different type of music from what you get over here.
Well, I mean, she is a very different artist.
Yeah.
I mean, she really is. So, what else we need to know?
Well, I put in a little plug, I guess. The main thing that drew me to the region was the job that I went for, and I have been the audiovisual coordinator over at Cleveland Community College. So a lot of the music functions that happen over there also kind of fall under my jurisdiction. That's everything. I'm a professional sound engineer doing live or recorded stuff. But I wanted to let you know that for the future of music that's happening all around this region, I've always just found it rough that there doesn't seem to be a lot of places that young musicians can feel comfortable.
There's not a place where even musicians feel comfortable. I mean, for this to be a music town, which has been designated, I was part of what was helping get it be one, the venues for musicians of any style are small.
Yeah.
I mean, to be such a music town... So with so many talented musicians, the opportunity to play in this town is small.
Small, and unfortunately growing smaller unless we go and you know, get involved, get organized in our musical community.
I agree.
But I see some light at the end of the tunnel, I think. Like, we have just started up some music programs over at Cleveland Community College, and they're a little bit different. Like, we do have a piano lab. We can teach you how to play piano over there. We have a new full-time music instructor, Heather Gerning. I probably butchered her name, but she has been phenomenal in kind of working with the different types of groups of people. She has, for instance, she has this ensemble class. Like, there's a lot of students that have come over there. They had an instrument that they played in high school. Sure. But we'll also get, we're not just a place for young folks, too. We've got some people from different ages, different backgrounds. And in the ensemble class, we get everybody together. We got somebody on piano. We got somebody with a bass guitar. We got somebody with a cello. And then we've got three singers. And we're, I've been trying to work with this group to have them rehearse on mic, working through their stage monitors so they can understand what it's like to be.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's important, really.
Yep. A lot of people don't get that experience. That's one of the things that we're trying to work on. And we got the Little Keeter Auditorium over there on April 25th. They're going to have a recital over there with the first generation of our music program.
You have an excellent amphitheater over there that that's for the most part never used. And I've talked to Omar Porter about this, so I know it's readily available.
Oh, yeah, it is. Omar is a good friend of mine, too. I played with him in an all-star band once at a Healing in Nature fundraiser activity.
Yeah, Omar's a great guy.
He is. He's phenomenal. And
he does a lot for this community.
Yeah, he does an absolute stellar job. But and Omar has been on my team about trying to get more music opportunities.
Sure.
Too. The amphitheater is a great space. Being the audiovisual guy, I know a little bit more about the background situation of the sound and technical systems. They need a lot of love. And when I say love, I mean in terms of investment. And that's a hard thing to come by for the arts.
Well, you know, it is. And
Now we make it work. We have partnerships where we've had Stan Lowry come out and bring out his sound system,
right.
And we have started to host concerts over there. And it's our hope that we'll keep doing these until the point that we can start saving up enough to get an infrastructure put in there for the concerts. That's the thing, is you can't really just go and get a whole bunch of speakers and leave them out in the elements.
Not there. I mean,
yeah.
Look, there's not. Even space-wise, there's not a whole lot of difference between the new Gardner Webb amphitheater and that one over there, as far as size.
Yeah,
you know, and
we have. There's a lot of us that would. I know that some people are endeared to that stage, but there are fundamental things that it needs. It needs more of a back room area. It needs a green room. It needs a lot. We've talked about if we were to go and clear that stage, we would really need to push it back, because I've also had to deal with a lot of feedback issues, because it's very close. You do have a very intimate performance if you get in that space, but we need to push the stage a little bit back. So I'm always going to the Cleveland Community College Foundation and just kind of putting a bug in their ear. It's like, if you want to have more engagement with the community, with the amphitheater, we need to reach out to investors or businesses or just other people in this community and talk about the realistic needs to go and upgrade it so it's more of a functional entity. We try to make it work. But we really hope we can make it better.
Yeah. I mean, it is a good, a useful facility sitting there that could be made to be a great facility.
Absolutely agree.
You know, at this point, I would say it is useful, but limited.
A little bit limited, yeah.
But it's there. It has potential.
The Keeter, which is, it's my baby. My office is literally right next to it, and I run so many events there. When I first came to the college, one of my first jobs was to upgrade the old Century lighting system that they had up in there. So we have a mixture of conventional and color-changing LED lights.
Right.
I got some decent sound systems, and I have a few portable speakers I can put out. Its limitation is it only holds about 200 people, and its backstage can be a little cramped. And a lot of people, they want to do plays. We do graduations there all the time. So that's another space that we're looking to make some modifications at other rooms that are nearby, mm-hmm. to have better dressing rooms. We're looking to have the music department relocate near there. They rehearse and perform and do their classes on that stage right now, but we have to like clear off their whole rig, and I got to change it up for.
Wait. Y'all have a music program at Cleveland Community these days?
Oh yeah, we certainly do. We got ensemble classes. We have a little lab of computers that will teach music mixing.
Yeah.
Off of those. We have a piano lab up there, the one where the instructor can hook up with the headsets. Sure. And like you can get about 12 people up in there, and we can teach you to play the piano. And our instructors will help you continue to perfect the instrument that you've come in with, and we can also give you instruction in music theory and things that can help you if you want to continue with a career in higher education in music, things that will help you transfer over to bigger music schools.
No, that's cool. I did not realize that. That's something, of course, that's the arts always get kind of shoved under when people are talking about what is available at your school.
Yeah.
I mean... Marching bands don't exist these days. I'm sometimes surprised that Justin even gets to teach anything, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, we even have a pep band in the making for some of our sports venues, and we're the new basketball court that we made. We even have a small stage over there, and we have a system that we have ordered, and it should be installed a little bit later this year, hopefully toward the summer. But it will give the ability for bands to also perform on that stage as well, with full stage monitors supporting everything.
Yeah,
so
that's really cool. Yeah, that's good stuff to know.
I'm hoping that all of these things will have more outlets for younger or startup musicians.
Sure.
to get a start with a little bit of an audience.
Yeah,
and I really hope some of the business leaders around here can come and attend these shows, come and see what's growing here in this county, and give them a chance.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to come do this today.
Thank you, Stan. I appreciate you, too.
All right.